Welcome to Community Living Show here on the NCRA Radio Networks. And, of course, our full-hour show on the on UBC Campus Radio, CITR 101.9 FM.
You've got a friend in me. You've got a friend in me. When the road looks rough ahead, you're miles and miles from your nice warm bed, you just remember what your old past said. Boy, you got a friend in me. Yeah, you've got a friend in me.
You got a friend. Welcome to Community Living Show here on the NCRA Radio Networks. I'm Kelly Rayburn. Along with me is Michael Rubin. How are you doing, Michael?
I am doing well, although I admittedly it has been a rather interesting week.
Besides, your car broke down?
Oh, my car broke down, and my hard drive for my video production company.
Oh, it's
crashed. I have another company looking. Hopefully, they will call me with good news and say, "Hey, we can recover all of your data."
Hey, good news! We have recovered your.
Yeah. So yeah, but right now it's kind of glim.
Glim. Mm,
but okay. it always picks up, right?
Yeah, of course.
So, but these are. These are just the things that happen when you own the place instead of just being an employee.
Right.
Yeah. So, there's other more important things going on that I wanted to address. Because I was out with Cheryl Young at a walk and talk for the Fibromyalgia Wellspring. And I was also at Jimmy Jackson's book launch. And there's two things that really came out when they were talking about hidden disabilities. And it was the type of bullying that was actually happening to them. So I thought I would play a couple clips from it. And, maybe you can give a little feedback about it too. So,
yeah. So okay. This is, of course, a new radio station here at the new campus. So there may be some minor glitches because
figuring things out.
Exactly, because I don't even know which ones are which for this.
So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, we're going to see what happens here. If you hear some silence, you know that means we're trying to get some self organized here.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
I'm going to plug this in and we'll see what happens.
All right. And so Michael is plugged in. Prepared for plugged in. And this damn microphone is starting to. There we go.
Hey, you finally got the right spot, right?
Yes. So I can aim for the computer, so my side, and aim
for
you.
We are playing. But we are not hearing anything. Uh-oh. That's definitely a bad sign. Hang on.
I've got everything on. In case anything happens. Yeah.
Okay.
These things happen here, folks.
All right. Let's try again. Pushing play now.
Today we're in Guilford doing a walk and talk with Julie here from our service support group. See, this is what I want to hear from you, is because people out there are wondering, how can we be doing such a walk? Mm-hmm. It's a long way, and we're all disabled, and we're invisible because...
That's a big question.
Exactly. How can we do such a thing? And have a medical personnel there just checking us up, vitals, make sure we're good. It's an adventure. And if you think of it that way, You're doing something you might never do again.
Exactly.
You know, be a part of something, creating awareness for people like ourselves who look great, but we're actually...
It's hard. All over the internet now, creating awareness, conferences, and just talks. I'm amazed how popular it is now.
Okay.
It's great. I'm trying to copy most of the talks, but they're so long that I've run out of space. But it just goes to show that it's really a popular item at the moment.
It definitely is.
Finally.
Yeah, well, we worked hard at it. Now it's out there. Now it's just a matter of making this walk happen. And it's huge, as you can imagine.
It's totally saddening how many thousands of people are in the same predicament. And how terribly wrong they've been treated.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Myself included.
Yep.
And people before support groups just lived with it and cried and were sad and just carried on. But now we have all sorts of support. It's wonderful.
Well, it's like myself in 92, the doctor said, I can't do a thing for you. Yeah. That's it, right? So we'll just go around there. So, yeah, I'm glad things in one way is better, but it still hasn't changed either.
No, it hasn't changed for most people that haven't been concerned with it or had anyone with a disease that's invisible. That's the main thing. And I feel like I'm being bullied.
I agree.
Because I don't look ill.
No.
How dare I ask for any help? How dare I ask for a handicapped door opener in my instance. But after 2 years of fighting, I got it. But I'm still waiting for a sound apology.
Exactly.
And hopefully the person to be more educated about all invisible diseases. And not only him, but hopefully all strata managers, let's say, will be educated through this process. It's not much to ask for. Just a little empathy would be nice.
Yeah.
A little more understanding.
And treat us like a person, not like an illness. And recognize that, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
The main thing is that even though we might look good, they have no idea what we go through when we aren't being seen. In my case, I'm out and about, and then I go to bed. And then I'm out and about, and I go back to bed. It's an ongoing process. But people don't see me when I'm lying in bed.
No.
Or on my bed, I should say.
That's where we become reclusive. We become invisible.
Exactly.
And we hide.
Exactly.
Yes. And why should we?
Exactly.
So also one of the things with the walk is it's promoting our community village we've got planned for the foundation.
Yeah, that's one thing I'm really excited about.
You're one of the ones that are going to be living there.
I know.
So we're awesome. It's going to be so exciting.
I'm telling all sorts of people. And they just look at me in wonderment like I'm on another planet. I mean, what is this woman talking about?
Yeah.
But I'm talking about my home.
Yeah.
My future home.
Yes. I'm looking forward to that. And this walk will make more awareness for the community village because people will realize that special things are needed for people with invisible illnesses. And that one of them is food. Sorry, but it's obviously a necessity, not a luxury.
That would be nice.
Yeah. So this is one of the things the village will make sure is we have good diets and be able to have more freedom and work on more natural plans to help our bodies. So, yeah. So we
can stop for a little break.
That was the first clip, and that was Lady Julie. She's helping. She's actually going to be taking part in the walk, the fibromyalgia walk from Langley, BC to Banff, Alberta. She said that she'll probably just do the first leg from like Langley to Abbotsford or something like that. But the whole walk was maybe 12 minutes, and we about got halfway around the mall before they started getting fatigued. And everybody, the whole point in what they're saying the bullying is people see them as being perfectly abled, but getting that winded in 12 minutes and halfway around a mall at the Guilford Town Center, it's a little, you know, you can see where the disability starts to come in.
Of course.
Yeah, you know. Yes. With the pain and the fatigue. So.
Yes.
And the lady Jolie, who was also speaking, she had said something about it took her 2 years to get a the push plate to open your door.
The plate?
Yeah, the push plate to open like the main door.
Oh, push plate.
Yeah, the push plate.
Oh, plate, P-L-A-T?
Yeah. P-L-A-T, the push plate, that you use to open a door so you can enter your building.
Okay.
It took her 2 years to get one put on her condo.
So it took a while.
Yeah. The Strata didn't think it. They thought that she was crazy, and they ignored her request.
Wow.
So, that's all kind of crazy. This next clip is from Jimma Jackson's book launch that happened, I think it was last week.
Mm-hmm.
And this lady, she gets pretty passionate about how her friends, they don't believe that the fatigue is that bad. It's just being tired.
Mm-hmm.
You should be able to push through it. She's lazy. All that kind of stuff is what her friends were calling. So I'm gonna play the clip a little bit, and you'll see what I mean about how passionate she gets, and a little answer back from Jimma Jackson.
Okay. Here we go.
One of the things that I have a lot of trouble. We talk about support systems, but for the most part, I find. Who have known me for over 20 years, even longer, they just simply won't believe me. They will not accept it. They just think I'm lazy, and they tell me in my face, and they tell me what jobs I can get. And I told this lady recently, she wants me to work in this daycare. Well, I can, I've got a CE as well as I'm teaching, but I said, I can't do it. I'm paid all the time. It's bad for 2 years right now. And what do you do then? Another friend who puts me down, and literally they think I'm lazy. And even
So there's
deal with it, because if you don't look the part, and then I get discriminated against based on hypoglycemia, fibroblog, I get discrimination. I'm thinking quite a human rights about it.
Yeah.
No. Well, I recommend the human rights issue too. I don't know what you're doing with your.
I know the BC Human Rights Tribunal intimately. I've been through all of them.
Yeah, I've done human rights too.
So if you want to contact me, we can talk about that another time. But I won't get into legal issues today, but I do fight a lot for discrimination because I'm a person with disabilities and I'm trying to work, and you wouldn't believe how hard it is whether I'm too old or people discriminate against my disability. It's a battle, and I'm a fighter, so I'll speak up. So. That's why I've got so much. But about your question, Mariana, there's a lot in my book about people's perceptions. And you know what? It's not about you. It's about them.
Oh, yeah.
So you really always have to remind yourself about that. It's just they're trying to look in the mirror, or they're being hard on themselves. They're not really trying to be hard on me. And when you read the last third, you'll get nuggets of my wisdom and insights on people and perceptions and... You know, and sort of how people perceive you and discriminate. And I cover it pretty well in there. So hopefully after you read the book, let me know after you read the book if it's helped you that way. Because it's too much to go into detail about how to really treat people and discriminate you, except to stand up to them.
So you had the background blowing air and everything. So
yeah, well, it was recorded in the new UBC alumni building that's right across from us.
Okay. At least it wasn't near the Museum of Anthropology there.
Yeah. Well, which, by the way, is a very nice building. I'll give UBC credit for building very nice facilities.
Right.
But that building is not finished, so that's why we're still hearing the air handlers.
Yes.
But I know it's a little rough, but her own friends were sitting there calling her lazy because she won't get out and work.
Right.
The reason why a lot of book launches happen between 7 and maybe 8 for a reason is mm-hmm. because that way people who can get off work and go, and they'll still get plenty of rest by the time they get home to get up for next work the next day.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a targeted group of people that isn't exactly true.
Right.
They suffer from chronic fatigue, and they need longer amounts of sleep and things mm-hmm. like that. So the book launch actually ended at about maybe 6:30 that particular day. Mm-hmm. And I actually had to drive a couple of the ladies home because they were just too exhausted to jump on the bus. I mean, it's not a thing that they're complaining. Oh, I'm just so tired. Is one of those is like you could see it in their eyes.
Okay, they were just completely dozed off.
Yeah, it's like you could see the exhaustion in their eyes. It's like wow. So it's like we have to, as one person in the clip said, is like empathy.
Mm-hmm.
Just give them a little bit of understanding when they're saying, hey, I'm having trouble doing this,
Yeah.
A little empathy, a little help, But yep. We all need that sometimes, right?
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, you have some other things to speak about, right?
Well, I was going to do that until the break. So why don't we just take a break and we'll be back with my stuff and we'll get on to that. All right?
Yeah.
All right. This is Community Living. We'll be back in a moment. Here we go.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
UpJars is hosting the first ever Clean Up the Ocean concert on Saturday, July 4th from noon to 8 p.m. at the Prospect Point Picnic Site in Stanley Park. Hear live music from the Green Seeds Music Society, Gabe and the Oyaz, the John Pippis Band, Tan and High, DJ Stamina, and more. Tickets are $50. Proceeds go to Cleaning Up the Ocean. Children and the differently abled get in free.
Welcome to Community Living Show here on the NCRA Radio Networks. Okay, some of my excuse me, some of the emails that I have received are from Autism Speaks, and most of them are from the United States, but most of them are very interesting. This one's about the 2015 Leadership Speaks on the Leadership Summit. Comments by Mary Snow and panel of discussions with Dr. Tom Instill, Director, National Institute of Mental Health, Richard Moss, the Vice President of Neuroscience, Clinical Development, and so on. So they mostly talk about a lot of autism stuff. So you might want to hear all of this stuff. So
yeah,
this one's about close to 37 minutes. So on YouTube. And of course, you can always check their Autism Speaks as well. I don't know. I mean, they do have a website, Autism Speaks. Probably they do have one in Canada
yes.
as well. So
yeah.
Here's the one again. Here's the one that is in the States right now. So check it out.
Great to see you again. And this audience is way more informed than I am. So I apologize if any of my questions seem basic, but our goal here today is to take a look at the science and also how it translates into public policy. You've talked about a lot of exciting initiatives. We want to get down to the bottom of it and hopefully bring home how you can use this science when you go back into your communities and integrate it into your lives and public policy. And we have a very distinguished panel here. The goal of our panel, the title of our panel, is The Revolution Driving Autism Research. So we have a lot of exciting initiatives. I think you'll find it really informative and have a ton of questions. So I'd like to introduce our panel. And they're with us, right about to come on the stage, Dr. Thomas Insel, the director of the National Institute of Mental Health. Richard Mose, vice president for neuroscience clinical development at Eli Lilly.
You might want to adjust your volume as well because it's very minimum. So turn up your volume just a little bit.
Of the National Institute of Mental Health. Richard Mose, vice president for neuroscience clinical development at Eli Lilly. And Mary Woolley, the president of Research America. We really are so grateful that all of you are here. What we're going to do is talk to each one of you individually and talk about the research you've been doing. Rob, I hope your knowledge can help guide me through this. And then we'll talk to all of you about the takeaway at the end of this panel. And Dr. Insel, I want to talk to you before. Rob was just telling us about the story of autism, and we really want to get the big picture in terms of what do we know in 2015, talking about this revolution driving autism research, what do we know today?
Well, we are still a very early stage, so I think we have to be humble in trying to say what we can do. If you think about that Rob slide that had the sort of discovery, development, dissemination, on every one of those columns, we're at an early stage, probably closer to where areas of cancer research were in the 1980s, early 1990s. So yes, we know there are genetic factors. We don't know what those particular genes are. We know there are environmental factors, and we have yet to identify a smoking gun in that place. We think of this as a disorder that's medical and needs treatments, but we don't have treatments. Medical treatments for the core symptoms. And most of all, I don't think we have a really good picture. We have an understanding that this is a very heterogeneous disorder. Maybe a little bit like the way we used to think about chest pain. When there were lots of different kinds of chest pain, and we didn't have the tools yet to identify those subgroups. This is very heterogeneous. And so before we can make that next step to develop the diagnostics and treatments that we need, and to get to the point of dissemination, one of the things that would be really important is to identify the, you could call it the taxonomy, identify the types of autism. What are they? In the way that today we think about the kinds of, different kinds of breast cancer, different kinds of heart disease. We don't think of it as one single diagnostic group. And that's what we mean by precision medicine. You're going to hear more about that from Joe Handelsman in a few minutes, but this idea that the pathway to better outcomes could be through better diagnostics.
Before we get to precision medicine, we've heard a lot of talk about genomes. And I'm just going to ask you a very basic question, if you could describe exactly what we're talking about.
Well, we all have a genome, and it has 3 billion bases, and it's very simple. It's just essentially, it's like a long string of text that goes on for 3 billion letters. And for every one of us, that text is slightly different. On average, there are about 3 million differences between each of us, unless we have an identical twin. So the genome is that kind of fundamental biological fingerprint that we all have. And the question that we're struggling with is that variation that is so common to all of us, in some ways, does that define not just our individual fingerprint for who we are in terms of our height and our hair color and our personality, but does it also define our risk for various diseases? And we know in some rare cases that there are either single base or sometimes much larger changes that are really important for conferring risk. Diseases like cystic fibrosis and Huntington's disease are sickle cell. They are genomic diseases. There's a lesion in the genome. Everybody who has that lesion gets this disease. So far, that has not been true for autism. We have found very few individual lesions. There's some,
right. But
they're very rare, and we don't often find them. Even in the same family, where there are multiple people with autism, we may find different lesions in the genome. So it's really a complicated area right now. And again, we're still early days where we know a lot about the variation that's there,
mm-hmm.
but we haven't quite been able to understand the connection between all of that variation in the text, if you will. It's kind of like the narrative of who we are,
mm-hmm.
and how that plays out in the story, in whether somebody actually develops a disorder or not. And that's not just unique to autism. It's the same story for lots of other both brain disorders as well as disorders of other body systems.
I was going to add, you know, and I think genetics has been driven recently as much by technology as it has been the need to want to search for that variation. It took 10 years, over $3 billion more human man hours than it took to put a man on the moon to sequence that first human mm-hmm. genome, to decipher every letter of code. First time, we can now do that for $1,000 in just a few days' work. So it's really changed the landscape of possibility in pursuing those questions.
And when you talk about this genetic research and precision medicine, where is the connection of that story?
So the hope is, and I should just clarify, because we have to manage expectations here.
Yeah.
that the hope is that the genetics will give you a target. They will take you to a place whereby finding lots of these variants that line up, that identify a subgroup, all of a sudden you'll be able to say, oh my goodness, what we've been calling autism spectrum disorder is 27 different disorders. And each mm-hmm. of those 27 requires a very different treatment. Now, the reason I say this is a potential and there's hope here is that is precisely where we are for breast cancer, colon cancer, and some forms of lymphoma, and lung cancer for that matter. So we used to talk about colon cancer. Today we know that there are probably 15 different kinds of colon cancer, and they require 15 different treatments. And it's only from the advent of that insight that we've begun to see mortality come down. So that's the great news in cancer. Is that going to be true for autism? Well, it's a different sort of problem in a way, because the mutations in cancer are found only in that tumor. They're not found in the blood. So we can take out that tumor, we can find that mutation, and we can dial up the drug that's going to be the best for that person. We don't know that we have that opportunity. We know we can't take out the brain and find that mutation in a particular part of the brain in a person with autism. It may be that we're finding all these variations in blood, and maybe what most of those variations will be kind of genes that are important for surveillance, for making sure that when there's a DNA glitch, it gets corrected or doesn't get corrected or something like that. So it could be a step or two away from the actual mutation that's leading to changes in behavior or brain development. So all of this is still at an early stage, and you have to be... You can't say we're not going to do it, because as Rob says, you can do it faster, better, cheaper than you could have imagined even 5 years ago. So this is a revolution. It would be like saying, if you want to go to San Francisco, do you want to walk or do you want to take a jet? Mm-hmm. So you have to take the jet, right? Unless you just want to take your time. But but to manage expectations, we don't know yet whether this is going to give us the targets that we will need for treatment development. And we've had the genes for Huntington's disease for now over 20 years without having a new therapy. The same is true for sickle cell. For cystic fibrosis, however, that actually did lead to an absolutely breakthrough treatment last year. The problem was, and this is the other thing to think about in this whole area, that breakthrough treatment called ivacaftor, which is really virtually a cure for cystic fibrosis, only works in 4% of the kids with CF. That's what precision medicine is all about. You identify these subgroups within what is now a very heterogeneous sample and develop interventions accordingly.
And talking about identification and genetic research brings in the missing project, right? And exactly, or the best you can explain, what is the goal and how does it work?
The goal is to generate as much detailed information about the genomes of individuals with autism as we possibly can, and to make that data available as openly and broadly as we possibly can. You know, betting on the innovation and ingenuity of researchers around the world who can access that data. You know, for the reasons I laid out just a moment ago, just 5 years ago, the idea of being able to sequence at this depth individuals at this pace would have been considered, you know, unlikely, impossible. Now it is possible. So our investment is to try to generate that data as fast as possible and get it to scientists who can analyze that.
And this may be a bad analogy, you tell me, but it almost has a simple comparison to maybe crowdsourcing research, right? Is that the basic idea?
Yeah, absolutely. The central thesis here is that the more eyes we can get on data like that and have all the tools and compute resources necessary to analyze it, the greater the probability that transformative discoveries will happen.
What is in the way now in terms of groundbreaking advancements?
On the genetics front or just generally?
Well, and then generally.
I think it has been data and access to data. Genetics data the generation of the data has exploded in recent years. But because of the technical challenges of moving that data around, I just gave you a sense of the scale of that. The field has had to overcome the technical issues of finding a home for that data and actually marshaling the computational horsepower and approaches to asking questions of it. But there is a legal and ethical dimension to entering this game that we're finding with our missing program that is a bit challenging too. You know, the missing program itself is on the forefront of a much larger genetic revolution that is struggling with how you share information like that, putting the complete genetic identity of individuals up into a cloud is something that hasn't been done before.
And brings about challenges.
Indeed.
Right, privacy concerns, I'm sure, one of them.
Privacy being concerns, absolutely essential that we protect the privacy that we agreed to when we originally consented families. So we're working with the Global Alliance for Genomics and Healthcare to help try to build new policies that help shape the consenting of families in participating in research.
I also wanted to talk to you about the value chain that you mentioned when you were talking to us just a few minutes ago. And when you talk about the value chain, how does that translate into the research that you're doing?
Well, I think it really provides that framework, that construct for how value is created in research. But I think some of the challenges we face are really now as we proceed further down that value chain and new partners in industry and other places who are required to actually take on these next steps. We're getting alignment and coordination and maximizing the investments that we all have available to make in this space, I think, will increasingly become a challenge. But we've got congratulate Tom and his leadership with the Interagency Autism Coordinating Committee. It is platforms like this that give us a regular forum to discuss that alignment, that coordination as the field journeys down the value chain together rather than disparately.
And as you mentioned, this is a very different discussion than you may have had just a few years ago, right? And we're talking about this groundbreaking research and these new efforts. But in terms of Richard Moe's of treatments, what are the biggest roadblocks companies like yours are facing?
Okay, well, developing new medicines is hard. It costs a lot of money. And it gets harder all the time. If you look across all therapeutic areas, I think the number of truly innovative new medicines that gets approved every year is roughly constant. It's probably in the 20 to 30 range across all therapeutic areas. But the amount of money that the pharmaceutical industry collectively expends has gone up, you know, like tenfold over the past 20 years or something like that. Now, the good news of that is once a drug is approved, you've always got it. So the total number of medicines available continues to increase. But human biology, as was described here, is very complicated, and trying to figure out new, previously unexplored diseases as complicated as something like autism is just extremely hard. But what makes us optimistic about the likelihood that this might eventually be impacted by new medicines is that we have tools. Years ago, it would have been impossible for a company to think about a new biologic target on the basis of genetic data. I mean, that just didn't happen. We found most medicines kind of serendipitously. Like you just took some people who were ill and they got something and some of them miraculously got better, and that's how things were discovered. We like to think of it now as much more rational, that we actually try to identify biological abnormalities, then our pharmacologists and our biologic colleagues get together and they try to find a molecule that will alter that biology in some way. Then we have new technologies like brain imaging that allow us, in the right circumstances, to actually be able to understand whether or not we're moving biology in the right way. So we have tools, but still the biologic processes are extremely difficult. As Tom mentioned, our knowledge about the targets that are relevant to autism is still extremely primitive. That knowledge, as it matures, we will begin to get more and more clinical candidates. And we call it research because we don't know what we're doing. If we knew what we were doing, it wouldn't be research.
You're scaring us a little.
You know, well, look, I think this is something we have to face. If you look across all therapeutic areas, to get one approved new medicine out, usually if you track it back, you probably have to start with about 30 biologic targets. At least 10 of those have to lead to actual clinical trials with new molecules that you enter into clinical development. And you're lucky if you can get one out at the end. And that's if you're considering diseases in the mix, where we know a lot more than we do about autism. We're talking about things like diabetes, where, you know, my company does a lot of work in diabetes. Pretty much everything works because we know a lot about how. But still, if you went into something like autism, those numbers are probably much higher. So we got to get the level of activity across this whole thing at a much higher level. And with these new technologies, we will be able to ultimately do that. But it's going to be a slow process. And I would like people to understand that you shouldn't be afraid of failure. We fail probably 95 times out of every 100 that we start out because it's research. If we knew what we were doing, it wouldn't, you know, we would be smarter. But with these new technologies, hopefully those failures are informative failures, so that even within a company that has to make a profit, if we can show that we've done studies that actually lead to better understanding of the disease, better understanding of the molecules, we can then still get latitude to go on and look at the next best molecule. And ultimately, that iterative process will lead us to things that aren't probably cures right out the back. And they'll be like Tom mentioned, it might be something that only works in a very small number of people. But once you get that lever, you can then work off of that to get better and expand out to other patient populations. So I think the good news is that the technologies for finding targets and interrogating them clinically are much better than they used to be, but the problems, as Tom mentioned, are still extremely hard.
And you mentioned timelines. Can you give us an example?
Oh, the timelines are long. Well, let me just give you some examples. The company that I work for was the first company to develop a commercial insulin formulation in 1930. We're still looking at better ways to improve glucose control 80 years later, and so are other companies. So it's not all at once. They're a lot better. In another area, Alzheimer's disease, our company started its first discovery program 27 years ago. We have never yet marketed a product for that disease, but we think we're getting closer. Even for a given molecule, once you identify a given molecule and you begin to take it through early toxicology, the discovery biology programs, you're probably not going to get to an actual clinical trial in people for about 10 years. And then from that, if everything works out well and you go through phase one, phase two, phase three, and regulatory approval, it's probably going to be another 8 years. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of timelines we're talking about. And to go back to the value chain that Rob was talking about, you have to have a lot of activity across there, and it's going to involve multiple partners, government, private philanthropy, advocacy, companies of various types, large companies such as the one I work with, but a lot of small companies. It's all part of the ecosystem to produce that stream of activity that's going through the system that collectively leads to increased knowledge and ultimately new medicines. And it doesn't have to be just medicines, by the way. It can be other kinds of interventions as well.
You spoke about partners, and I want to bring Mary Woolley in because your organization really converts the science into public policy, correct?
Well, we work on that edge. You're right, Mary. And, so I'm a political scientist, not the kind of scientist that these gentlemen are. But I'm committed to making sure that you all succeed. The sooner, the better. And that the fruit of your labors are delivered to all of us, and I do mean all of us, and including mothers and grandmothers like I am, because we're in a hurry. Mm-hmm. And we're not afraid to say so. And that's true of you all, too. You're an important part of the value chain and the value proposition, if you will. And I would say, over the years, not often enough heard from or attended to, whether by the research community itself, and that has clearly changed, but also by the public policy community. But I think it's really important to reconnect to why we do what we do. And with your permission, I want to give you a little story. It's very recent. That sure did the trick on reconnecting me. So if my eyes are as red as my dress, it's because I just got off an airplane. I was visiting unexpectedly with my son and daughter-in-law, whose new baby was coming in a very different way than they expected and were planning for as their first child, and they were freaking out. So my son called me up and said, Mom, can you come now? And I said, yes, of course. So I tried to keep them calm for a few days. Everybody's quite sleep deprived. There's a very happy ending here. There's a very happy ending. But I was really struck by the wisdom of a nurse named Mona. She was very wise in many ways. But at one point, they had to take my new grandson, Benicio, to have blood drawn in a sterile environment. And the nurse said to my son, now Dad, it's important for you to go with him. You don't have to, but it's important. Because it's just going to galvanize you in complaint. It's going to steal your soul, though. Because someday, he's going to make you walk through fire for him, and you will willingly do that.
Sorry, we're going to have to take a break there. We've got another... few more minutes to go on this thing, and then we'll wrap it up. This is a community living show.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts on Commercial Drive and other areas at
Bill and Rattle Music Limited, High Life Records, People's Co-op Bookstore, Audio Pile Records, Bad Bird Media, Band Merch Canada, Vancouver Music Gallery, and Pandora's Box Rehearsal Studios.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
Show is the start of the weekend. We play all types of D&D or jungle for the first half of the show. On the second half of the show, it gives you that irritating noise that you just don't want to hear it. Or it could be some ambient sounds that might drift off and or fall asleep in the moment of life. Or it could be some new age that you just heard on most stations, but even better. Or it could be that this music has no beat or drums in that music. Either way, tune into the Late Night Show, now broadcasting on Saturday mornings at 12:30 p.m. right after the Medicine Show, also hosted by me, DJ Rain, and Jason Lawrence. If you happen to hear us around the world, you can always check us out at citr.ca. We just had to do that. Anyways, this is the Community Living Show here on CITR 101.9 FM. That's the flagship station for the NCRA Radio Network stations. And now we're going to go back to the Autism Speaks with the diagnosis to treatment.
And as she said, oh my God, because I knew that among other things, one of the things my son was thinking was that many of his peers and his stepbrother are walking through fire because of the autism spectrum. And me too. It's there all around us. And we're looking for more answers, be they behavioral, be they pharmaceutical products. And the way we're going to get them is by speaking out. And that's where you come in. That's what we do. We speak out in ways that people who work for the federal government at the NIH can't do. They're constrained because they're employees of the government from saying, we need a lot more money in all of the elements of research, basic, translational, and we need a lot smarter regulatory environment so that for industry and also for academia and for people in government themselves, we're dealing in the 21st century with regulatory systems that apply to the 21st century rather than in a kind of horse and buggy age using regulations that were designed in the last century for today's science, which is quite different, as has been described here.
And there was a question earlier about 21st century cures.
Yes.
Which is something you're very
involved
with.
This is truly a moment for science in Washington, in the Congress, one that we haven't seen for over a decade, and it's overdue. And you're going to be hearing later this morning from the leaders who are driving this momentum, Congressman Upton and Congresswoman DeGette. And they have been extraordinary. And I hope everybody says that to them today. Because a little over a year ago now, they decided that it was going to be a legacy commitment for the two of them to really move the entire research ecosystem, including the funding part and the regulatory part, and making sure that the patient's voice was at the center of it all, move that into the 21st century. And they have been doing just that. And it's spurred a whole series of individuals who haven't spoken out for years, if ever, about their commitment to research. And I heard just the tail end of Senator Iote, typical of many fiscal conservatives who are saying, we need to make an exception, if you will, for funding, for the federal government to fund science. And of course, it's not only the federal government, but the federal government piece is critically important. So we're really, it's almost as though people are elbowing each other out of the way to be a champion for research. So this is an opportunity moment. But first, we got to get this bill across the finish line in the House of Representatives. And I'm sure they'll talk to you about this, but that could be happening
still this month, but it won't happen unless every member of Congress hears from people like you and everyone you know, frankly, that it's important to you and important to this country to complete the job and get it done, and then on to the Senate.
And I'd like all of you to share in this discussion. I think a lot of the people in this room want to know, how does all of this, what does it mean to me? What does it mean to my family? A lot of advocates, organizers are here wanting to know, what's the next step? Where do we take this? So first off, I'd just like to open that question and get your ideas on this, is what is the science, in practical terms, mean for the families in this room?
Mary, maybe I can jump in since we are the largest funder. And just to put this in context, a lot of what we've been talking about, genetics, for instance, represents only about 10% of what we support in autism. If you look at what are the big initiatives of the last year, there's a very large project through the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences on environmental factors, and now creating large cohorts and sometimes deep studies of what those factors might be. We've supported 12 new projects that'll be a total cost of $40 million on community services. How do you help the transition from youth to adulthood? How do you help adults in the autism spectrum? That's an area that we keep hearing about. It's just been so neglected.
And a huge issue.
Huge issue, and that's not gonna be, you know, just genetics. It's gonna be lots of other things that we're gonna be doing to make sure that there we have some near-term wins. So a lot of what we've been talking about up here is kind of the long-term view, and that's important. This is a little bit like managing your financial portfolio at home. You want to have some long-term and some short-term gains, and we're now very focused on having to have some short-term gains, and those actually are taking those things we do know today and making sure that we do them. I was just blown away by this recent study that showed that if you can identify kids very early in the first year and get them into an intensive behavioral program like the Early Start Denver model that's been developed, that as you follow them over time, they do better and better and better. So the new data that just came out this past month show that looking at the kids at they started at age 18 months to 3 years. We knew that at age 4, they looked very good. But at age 6, they look even better. And for the first time, the core symptoms are beginning to now show the impact of this intervention. And they're separating more and more from the control group in this study. So I think there are really promising things we know today that we can do better. And part of what our new research investments are about are moving those things into practice. If you will, going back to Rob's picture, you know, it's the dissemination piece. You don't want to wait 20 years. You don't want nobody who can wait 10 years to make things better. So What are the things we can do right now that can make a difference? And there are those things around early detection, early intervention, finding ways to make sure the services are in place after age 18, and then helping adults to be able to access those things that make a difference. And we now have an entire portfolio of those kinds of approaches. So I'm pretty hopeful that there's actually a lot that can be done even now.
Rob?
Yeah, I would echo that and add to it, you know, the need to create better ways of sharing this information. Beyond the actual studies that are being funded, there's a lot of secret sauce, if you will, out there in the community, things that are working, things that are helping families, helping individuals in the here and now. How do we tap into that, and how do we get better communication across the community and sharing that? That's a challenge worth taking on. And I would add to that the need to try to bring better clarity to families as they navigate what is out there, you know, among iPad apps and diets. There's a lot of noise in the conversation around science that could benefit from having some scrutiny brought to it, some authentication, if you will, some help with navigating through that noise to find things that are actually safe and are working now as this other story unfolds in the background with sustained pressure.
Yeah, I would just add, I think the reason why most of us who went into biomedical research is that we hope to create knowledge that is useful to people who have health problems. I mean, it's a very practical business. I mean, it's intellectually interesting to study about the brain and genetics and stuff, but most of us believe that the real value of what we do is we produce knowledge that has some utility for patients and for their families, whether it's, and it gives them more options. They know what to do. I mean, one of the worst things when I used to work back in the hospital is families just don't know what to do. They don't see any hope. They don't see any options available for them. And so we'd like to give them knowledge about what the options are that are currently available and make sure that the options available to them in the future are both more of them and better ones. And that's why we do what we do.
And Mary, how do families become catalysts for change?
Oh, there's a rich history of families working for change. And it goes, I would say, it goes back to the March of Dimes.
Actually, we're going to leave it there now. That's that was the Diagnose to Treatment, the Revolution of Driving Autism Speaks. You can always check them out on autismspeaks.org. I believe autismspeaks.org. There's also Kenny's website, autismspeaks.ca. Michael, what do you think of it?
A lot of great information there. Mm-hmm. You know, I like the definition of research. Mm-hmm. We're doing research because we don't know what we're doing. That is very true.
Mm-hmm.
I existed in the world of science and chemistry for a lot of years, and I was in the known part of what we were doing,
mm-hmm.
And it was very formulated and things like that. And we used to see some of the things that came along as research. And it's like, and it all looked completely brand new, in some cases, completely foreign.
Right.
You know, so.
It's interesting.
Yeah. It's like, there's a lot that we just need to learn about. Our bodies and our universe in general. So.
We got to give a big shout out to a birthday who's originally supposed to be from Tibet, but he's going to be on July 6th. Happy birthday to the holiness of the Dalai Lama, the 14th Dalai Lama, which of course is going to be 80 years old on July 6th. So happy birthday to the Dalai Lama. Wow. And yeah, so, and of course I just wrote a greeting birthday to him. So anyways, that's pretty much it for the show. I would like to thank you, Michael, for coming in as well. And yeah. You like the new station, right?
Yeah, this is pretty cool.
Yeah, so hopefully.
we have more windows, more view.
Yeah,
and we have sunlight.
Yeah. Yeah, more brightness from that other radio station. So we'll be back again next week, and we will take us out to a music in just a moment. Here we go. Well, we'll be back next week. Take care.
See ya.